I will not go any further and leave the discussion to my guests. So we would like to eagerly listen to Honorable Professor Sassoli for the as the first key speaker. Professor, please.
Yeah, thank you very much. Good evening. I'm very honored by this invitation, and I will be rather short on the rules on targeting. I have sent a text which you can then consult, and then go to accountability. Obviously, accountability, same problem, or nearly the same problem. There are some differences for targeting, as for ill treatment of prisoners or misconduct in occupied territories. So the accountability issue, and here the organizers have asked me to speak first whether a new mechanism could be established, and then about the possibilities and limits of the existing mechanisms. But let us first speak about targeting. So the basic rules on targeting is first, and I will not deal with this, a lawful weapon must be used. So even if you target combatants with chemical weapons, this is prohibited. Second, the target must be lawful, and I understand that this is the focus of our discussion today. Third, the proportionality rule must be respected. If the attack against a legitimate target risks to have also incident effect on civilians or on civilian objects, and even if those three rules are respected, all feasible precautionary measures have to be taken to minimize the impact on the civilian population. So, unfortunately, we have to avoid wars. But if we have a war, it's not always unlawful if civilians are killed, if those four basic rules are respected, and if these civilians killed are incidental, lawful attack against a military objective or against combatants, and if all feasible precautionary measures have been taken to minimize this. Now, what is a legitimate target? Let us first speak about human beings, combatants, members of the armed forces, or of an organized resistance group in an international armed conflict are legitimate targets. And in a non-international armed conflict, as you probably know, technically there are no combatants because no one has the right to. Therefore, there members of an armed group are legit targets, but only if they have a continuous combat function. This is at least the interpretation of the International Committee of the Red Cross, ICRC, and I agree with that, because obviously, unlike governmental armed forces, an armed group consists of all kinds of people who have no military function, but have an education function, have a social function. So it would be very dangerous if every member of an armed group could be attacked. Think about Hezbollah in Lebanon or Hamas in Gaza. And then civilians may be targeted if and for such time as they directly participate in hostilities. So that's the difference between a combatant and until the combatant surrenders or is wounded, sick, or otherwise out of combat, while directly participate in hostility. Now, let us speak about objects. military objectives may be attacked. By the way, the number of objects will may be attacked. It sorry remains a civilian and may not be targeted, while the weapons factory is a military objective and may be targeted, and the worker in the weapons factory may then be in the limitations of the proportionality rule, be an incidental victim of the attacks. So military objectives are those objects which contribute to enemy military action and whose destruction, capture, or neutralization offers a dual use object, so an object which is used both by the military and by civilians, or has a purpose. For instance, the internet is used by the military, but it's also used by civilians. Then it is, in my view, a military objective, but the civilian use of the dual use object has to be taken into account in the application of the proportionality rule. So if this dual use object is very important for the civilian population, it may be that it may not be attacked, although it also serves the military. And then only a military objective or combatants may be targeted. And if this is done, then still the proportionality rule applies concerning civilians who must be expected to be incidental victims of the attack. And there, the incidental effect on civilians may not be excessive compared with the concrete and direct military advantage of the attack. And these effects on civilians is not only like in the classical situation, civilians who live near a weapons factory or civilians who stand near an enemy tank, but also, so-called reverberating effects. So, for instance, if you bomb a military objective in midst of a city, you may also destroy incidentally the water pipes, and then the civilians have no more water. And if they don't have clean water, children will die because of diarrhea and so on. And this, if it is foreseeable, must be taken into account. These are the so-called reverberating effects. And finally, even if all this is respected, then precautionary measures must be taken. Active precautionary measure by the attacker and passive precautionary measures by the defender. But the attacker has clearly much more obligations than the defender. The defender is prohibited to use human shields, so to put civilians into a place to protect a military objective, and a much weaker obligation to take feasible measures to evacuate the civilian population. But we must be conscious that to evacuate people is a very risky thing in an armed conflict, because you must have another place where to put them. And then they must be fed, and they must have a medical assistance. So the classical rule for humanitarians is that civilians are always best to remain in the place where they are, and the military must make the war around the civilians, and you should not have to evacuate the civilians to allow the military to make the war. And active precautions are, even when the proportionality rule is respected, to try to reduce further the incidental effect on civilians. For instance, unless circumstances do not permit, to give a warning, or in many cases to attack by night rather than by day, because by night, in most cases, but it depends of the circumstances, there will be less civilians around, and also the choice of weapons and of the direction, for instance, of a missile. If you choose the correct direction, there is less risk for civilians around. And then there are specially protected objects which benefit from an additional protection. What is this additional protection? First of all, unlike normal civilian objects, which may be used for military purposes, and then they become military objective, when an object is specially protected, the side which is attacked may not use such an object for military purposes, and the attacker may not, like for normal civilian objects, attack them just because they have become military objectives. But there are additional restrictive rules which are different for every category of specially protected objects. And what are these specially protected objects? There are cultural heritage, the natural environment, objects indispensable for the survival of the civilian population, so for instance, crops or food or water, works and installation containing dangerous forces, so for instance, nuclear power stations, and medical units and transport. They have a special regime under the first Geneva Convention. Now, the problem with these targeting rules, and this is a problem to when you want to ensure accountability, is that we generally do not know, because, as you know, the military don't want to tell us what was their target, why they attacked it, how important this was. They don't want to tell us the plans they had. And therefore, it is difficult to judge whether those rules were respected in some cases. Also, because what counts is not the result, but ex ante. What was expected by the attacker. And mistakes are not prohibited, but mistakes should be avoided. And this is one of the aims of the precautionary measures. And this is different compared with the Geneva law rules. So, for instance, if a prisoner is tortured, you know there's a violation of IHL. If in an occupied territory a house is destroyed by the occupying power, this is a violation of IHL. While when it comes to targeting, the mere fact that, say, a school was destroyed does not yet prove that there was a violation of IHL, because we would need to know what was in the school at the time of the attack. We would need to know how important was this, by hypothesis, military target for the plan of the attacking party, and what precautionary measures were taken. And this, unlike for the Geneva law rules, we often don't know, and we cannot know. And so the solution would either be, like in human rights law, to request the parties to be transparent, to declare publicly what was the target, how important was this target, or to establish presumptions. But we don't have this presumption. Like then the attacking party must explain why, if it claims that it nevertheless respected international humanitarian law, it must explain what was the target, and also the defending party must explain whether any military facilities were near the place which was destroyed, and this is often not. Now let us speak about accountability and in particular the possibility to establish a new accountability mechanism. Well, I think we in this interesting meeting we have, I see we have 42 participants, I'm very honored, we could easily imagine an efficient accountability mechanism which would execute international humanitarian law, determine whether there was a violation, and would punish those who violate. So the problem is not to imagine a system, but that states do not want to have an efficient system, because unfortunately states want to have the option that they violate humanitarian law, therefore they don't want an efficient system. And this is not only about humanitarian law. It is also about international trade law. Think about President Trump and the custom duties he has introduced against several countries. I think Iran and Switzerland have the same level. We have 39% in Switzerland. And this is clearly against WTO law. But there is no effective mechanism to make this impossible. So there is no central adjudication and enforcement mechanism. Now, for humanitarian law, there have been some initiatives in the past
that they were not accepted by states.
One initiative was Switzerland, and the International Committee of the Red Cross wanted to have a very, very weak, I must say, don't tell the Swiss that I say that, but at least there was a mechanism, because in humanitarian law, unlike human rights law, we do not have a human rights committee or human rights council. We don't have a forum where violations of humanitarian law are discussed between states, and Switzerland wanted to institute such a forum, but it could not go through. It was at the International Conference of the Red Cross and the Red Crescent some 6 years ago. Then we have an international humanitarian fact, because most of the time the controversies about humanitarian law violations are not about interpretation of the law, but simply are about the facts. But this commission exists, but no one has ever seized the commission. So it was never able to work except in a very marginal case by an international organization has won. Seized it. But it doesn't make a lot of progress in the Human Rights Council. The International Commission of Jurists, I must say that I'm a commissioner of that commission, and also in the accountability mechanism. Now, this sounds very good, but it's quite limited. You know, perhaps, that there is an international mechanism looking into violations of IHL in Syria and trying to identify the persons responsible for those violations. A similar mechanism exists for Myanmar, and they have been established by the UN Human Rights Council and the General Assembly. But we said, why just for Syria and Myanmar? It is based also, first of all, it is typically a double standard, but also it's a waste of resources, because each time the Human Rights Council establishes a new fact-finding mechanism, and it has established a lot of fact-finding mechanisms on many armed conflicts, then you first have to find the experts and the staff and so on. While if there was a permanent mechanism, as soon as the Human Rights Council decides that in a certain conflict there must be fact-finding about responsibility for violations of humanitarian law, it would exist. Now, I don't think we need a new criminal ad hoc courts. You know, states, unfortunately, they like ad hoc, because ad hoc means you can be selective, and to have a criminal court for Yugoslavia and for Rwanda, but not for Gaza, for Ukraine, for Myanmar, for Sudan, and so on. And it is also a waste of means. So we have the International Criminal Court, and in my view, we should rather strengthen the International Criminal Court. Now, for targeting purposes, as I said before, an important improvement would be to find an obligation it should give explanations. Now, often, states are very vague about what was the target and why did they attack this and why did so many civilians die and so on. So, an obligation which exists in law but not in humanitarian law to explain why people were killed. And, as I said, presumptions. If civilians are killed, there's a presumption that there was a violation, except state can explain that it took all measures which are necessary to avoid. Obviously, ideally, we would need, and I said this in the beginning, a mechanism for all violations of humanitarian law. But politically, it is perhaps realistic to first start with some violations which are particularly shocking to public opinion. For instance, attacks against hospitals or sexual violence. And finally, an idea would be to have domestic mechanisms. You know, you have domestic mechanisms are supervised by an international mechanism. So to have a domestic mechanism which also looks into violations of humanitarian law, so that a state is not immediately criticized internationally, but that a domestic mechanism has an obligation to look into violations. Now, you have heard, and I hope I did not depress you, but you know the reality is depressing, that it's difficult to establish a new and more effective mechanism, not because we wouldn't have good ideas, but because states do not have the necessary political will. And still, some states also have a fear that this will be manipulated by those who are their enemies. And it is indeed very important that such mechanisms are really impartial, and it is not always easy to find really impartial people. Now let us speak about the effectiveness of the existing mechanisms. Now, we have to admit that there are widespread violations, and there is a selective silence by the international community towards those violations. Also, I would stress that the violations are perhaps public opinion evaluates the violations, which weakens which weakens the credibility of humanitarian law. And even very inhumane regimes like Iraq of Saddam Hussein, nevertheless, for instance, the Iranian prisoners of war were largely treated in conformity with the Third Geneva Convention. And in every armed conflict, I worked for the International Committee of the Red Cross. I have seen violations, but I also have seen a lot of cases of respect. And no one speaks about these cases of respect. But okay, there are violations, and there are too many violations. And here, the International Committee of the Red Cross, I'm not totally neutral, as was mentioned. I worked for them for 13 years in the last century, but does a good job, but it privileges access and bilateral confidential discussions, while we need also to establish violations and to denounce violations. And the ICSC itself admits that it cannot do it alone. There need to be other mechanisms. Now, we have an important mechanism, but I understand Professor Aslani will speak about this, Article 1 common to the Geneva Convention, which says that states do not only have to respect, but also to ensure respect by others. And this is unfortunately used at best selectively, not easily enough, and mainly against those who are anyway your enemies, while it should be used with those because you have more influence on your friends. Then we have the United Nations, which in some respects, it does a good job, but it is inevitably selective because there are the permanent members of the Security Council which can express their veto and then not done. And the United Nations is cannot be stronger and more effective than there. Which are the states want, and many states do not want to have a more efficient United Nations. Then there is international criminal law, and I think there has been a lot of progress, because many states, I don't know about the Iraq legislation, but many states have adopted in the last 30 years criminal legislation which criminalizes war crimes, crimes against humanity, genocide, and so on. And there is an increasing number of cases before international courts, but also before domestic courts, because for war crimes, there's universal jurisdiction. So if someone who has committed a war crime in Gaza or in Ukraine comes for holidays to Switzerland, the Swiss prosecutor has an obligation to arrest such a person and to prosecute the person, even if there's no other link with Switzerland than the presence of the accused. Now, a particular problem, you know, today with Gaza and Ukraine, we all think a lot about international armed conflict, but we have to be conscious that most armed conflict and most people die in the world from non-international armed conflict. And there is a particular difficulty to engage armed groups. And one of the aspects of it is the so-called fight against terrorism. Because obviously, if you call the armed group terrorist, you can no longer have a dialogue with them. While to get respect of humanitarian law, this is typically my experience in the Red Cross, you have to speak with people, you have to understand their problems, and you don't have to exclude them, but rather to include them. So I think the best avenue we have is prevention. Training and dissemination, and their National Red Cross and the Red Crescent societies, but also armed forces have made a lot of progress in training. You know, when I was in Switzerland, there's compulsory military service. When I was in the Swiss Army, we got a film about humanitarian law. Today, they make exercises in a maneuver is much more realistic when there are also civilians around. And you must decide what do we do when there are civilians, because a film will not train soldiers. An important point is to avoid the diabolization. And unfortunately, in today's world, there is a tendency to consider that the other party, by principle, always violates international humanitarian law. And this decreases the credibility of humanitarian law, because if you are convinced that your enemy anyway violates humanitarian law, no one wants to be the only idiot who respects international humanitarian law. Now, to conclude, I would say that IHL will nevertheless survive, because IHL is the difference between crime and war. What is typical for a war and makes a difference with a crime is that you kill people, but according to rules. And there are rules on how to conduct a war, while there are no rules on how to commit a crime, because a crime is only prohibited, while wars are also prohibited by public international law. But there is also a branch, and this is humanitarian law, which says that if there is a war in the certain rules, and this is international humanitarian law, and I can only hope that states understand that it is in their interest to have mechanisms which keep the credibility of those rules, because if no one anymore obeys those rules, then wars become even worse than they are today. Thank you very much.
We have many thanks to Professor Sassouli for his meaningful speech and opinions. I will ask my questions at the end of the program. At this time, respectfully and honorably invite the second key speaker of today's meeting, Dr. Jaafar Aslani. Dr. Aslani, please.
Okay, Dr. Malami, can you hear me clearly?
Yes, yes.
Okay, thank you. If you let me just a few seconds to share the screen, the few slides that I have already prepared. I can do that. Let me just a while, please.
You send any PowerPoint file?
No, I sent it to Mr. Travigan, if I'm not mistaken, but he told me before the presentation that you can do it by yourself. Let me just try to share it on the screen. But Mr. Fati, unfortunately, I couldn't do it, and I couldn't upload the screen with my presentation. I don't know.
Still, Miri, can you help Dr. Aslani or Mr. Sagafian?
Okay. I think I can do it. I can do it. Let me just well.
Okay.
Is it okay right now?
Yes. Yes, I see it.
Okay, thank you very much. Okay. First of all, greetings and best wishes for all of you. Good day to all. Greetings to all respected, distinguished professors, students, researchers, and all the audiences actually present at this online session today. First of all, let me, Dr. Maghami, I would like to give my special thanks to the Human Rights Research Group of the University of Isfahan for giving me the floor and this opportunity today. And also, I would like to thank you, Dr. Maghami, my dear friend and colleague, for chairing today's session. I'm very honored, actually, to be here with the distinguished and wise professor of international law, Professor Marco Sassoli. I must point out that I have already had the honor of sitting with Professor Sassoli in Geneva, and we have already met each other several times, and I have benefited really and really greatly from his valuable knowledge and experience, in particular in the field of international humanitarian law. In any case, Professor Sassoli's presence at this session and his presentation of his views and opinions on the recent and current development of IHL, and especially this 12-day war between Iran, Israel, and United States, is very valuable and important from the perspective of international humanitarian law. Dear ladies and gentlemen, and honored and distinguished colleagues, I stand before you today to discuss one of the most pressing and complex issues in IHL and international law and contemporary armed conflict. I mean, the obligation of states to respect and ensure respect for IHL. During the recent 12-day war involving Israel, United States, and Iran. Actually, as you know better than me, this conflict, though brief in duration, has profound legal, humanitarian, and also geopolitical ramifications. Therefore, I try to provide a critical study for examining the framework and scope of international legal obligations that govern the conduct of hostilities, the protection of civilians, and also the collective responsibility of the global community to uphold the IHL. To fully appreciate the legal complexities at play, it is necessary first to sit and take a brief look to the geopolitical and historical scene. As you will aware and better now than me, in early 2025, unfortunately, the Middle East was again thrust into violent confrontation. The joint Israeli-American military campaign was launched following months of escalating tensions concerning Iran's nuclear program and regional military activities. The campaign consisted primarily of precision airstrikes against Iranian military facilities believed to be involved in nuclear research, ballistic missiles production, and support for proxy groups hostile to Israel and U.S. interests. Key targets included command centers in Tehran, missile bases near Isfahan, and logistics centers in Homs. Despite the campaign's declared focus just on military targets, reports from multiple sources, including the United Nations, human rights organizations, and the ICRC, indicated widespread, unfortunately, damage to civilian infrastructure, hospitals, residential neighborhoods, schools, and essential utilities suffered heavy collateral damage, leading to significant civil casualties. Actually, and normally in response and in self-defense, Iran responded with missile attacks on Israel cities, and specifically the U.S. military base in Qatar known as Al Udeid Air Base. Unfortunately, civilian populations were caught in the crossfire, raising serious concerns about the violation of fundamental principles and rules of international humanitarian law. Unfortunately, this 12-day war has been a tragic intersection of military strategy, geopolitical competition, and legal efforts to impose humanitarian limits on the violence. Despite its short duration and the alleged precision of its airstrikes, this war has sadly resulted in the martyrdom of more than 1,062 people in Iran, including 100 26 women and unfortunately 47 children and adolescents. Let me now go straight and through the issue on the Article 1, I mean Article, Common Article 1 of the Geneva Conventions. Actually, Common Article 1 of the Geneva Conventions of 1949, requires all state parties to what? To respect, and as Professor Sosoli correctly reiterates, to ensure respect for the present conventions in all circumstances. This phrase, deceptively simple phrase, carries immense weight and imposes a dual obligation. First, respect, what does it mean? It is quite clear that the parties directly involved in hostilities must scrupulously adhere to the rules designed to protect persons hors de combat, civilians and civilian objects. This obligation is unconditional and universal, applying regardless of the conflict's nature, the actors involved, or the circumstances on the ground. Actually, legal and scholars and the ICRC emphasize that this duty reflect which not permitted. In addition to this, I would like to tell you that the ICJ has also underscored this in its jurisprudence, including the 2004 advisory opinion on legal consequences of the construction of a wall in the occupied Palestinian territory, which affirmed that all states under an obligation not to aid or assist violation of fundamental humanitarian rules and principles. Now let me to tell you some words about the belligerent's obligations. I mean, in this case study, about the Israel and the United States. As you know, Israel and the United States, both of them are parties to the 1949 Geneva Conventions. While the United States has ratified the additional protocols, Israel has not ratified the first protocol, but has accepted that many of its provisions represent customary international law according to ICRC study and rules, which all of you know as well. Their obligations during the 12-day conflict include, but are not limited to, the following core principles of IHR. First of all, as Professor Sassoli correctly referred to, the principle of distinction. It is quite clear, obvious, that this principle is fundamental. There is no doubt. It requires parties to distinguish at all times between combatants and civilians and between military objectives and civilian objectives. In Article 48 of the Additional Protocol 1, 1979. This means attacks may only be directed against military objectives. Civilian populations and objects must be protected. But let me tell you about the factual findings of the war between Iran, Israel, and United States. According to the satellite imagery analyzed by independent organizations, Israel and U.S. strikes hit residential districts in Tehran and Isfahan, nation's human hospitals. Suffered significant damage from aerial bombardment. In this regard, and according to the news published by official Iranian news agencies on June 15, again, missile attack and aggression, the Tajrish neighborhood shook with two explosions. The blast wave also, unfortunately, caused damage several kilometers away from the impact site. The Ministry of Health, Treatment and Medical Education of the Islamic Republic of Iran said on June 16th that, unfortunately, 12 people were martyred and about 59 civilians were injured in the Hodges Square explosion, one of whom was a pregnant woman. These attacks appear to violate clearly the principle of distinction unless justified by military necessity, which, of course, given the evidence and statistics of civilian casualties and the extensive damage to civilian facilities and infrastructure, not only has this necessity not been reliably proven, but has also led to a violation of the principle of distinction. Let me shift to the next principle of the International Humanitarian Law and Armed Conflict, which is proportionality. As you know, under Additional Protocol 1, Article 51, even when targeting military objectives, the law prohibits attacks that would cause excessive incidental harm to civilians or civilian objects in relation to the anticipated concrete military advantage and necessity. So what is the assessment here in this 12-day war? The reported civilian casualties, estimated over 1,000 dead and 5,000 injured, raise questions about whether Israel and U.S. adequately weighed proportionality. The destruction of power grids and water infrastructure, while potentially serving military purposes, also inflicted widespread suffering on civilians, particularly during the protracted blackout. It is quite clear that the next principle is the principle of precaution. According to Additional Protocol, well also, I mean, Article 57, belligerents must take all feasible precautions to avoid or minimize incidental civilian harm. This includes effective advance warnings where possible. Eyewitness reports and investigations show that warnings were often insufficient or absent. The timing of attacks during evening hours, when civilian presence in targeted areas was high, exacerbated casualties. If you let me, I'd like to say some words about the United States' role, I mean this shared and joint responsibility. Before and during the 12-day war, the United States provided intelligence, logistical support, coordinated operational planning with Israel, and at the end of the day, directly, unfortunately, participated in conflict against Iranian nuclear sites. On the morning of June 22, seven B-2 Spirit bombers, along with the large air force, dropped nearly 14 giant MOP bombs on the underground facilities of Fordowan near Isfahan site. And Tomahawk air-to-surface missiles were fired from American submarines towards Isfahan. The fundamental issue and the main issue is, do the Fordo or Natanz sites constitute military objectives from a humanitarian law perspective? An objective examination shows that the facilities attacked were under formal International Atomic Energy Agency supervision. They were not holding military weapons at the time of the attack. Direct participation in a military operation has not been proven. Consequently, targeting such facilities is in serious confrontation with the principle of distinction and the principle of military necessity. Even if a military attack is deemed legitimate, which is not the case here, international humanitarian law, I mean IHL, in particular the Geneva Conventions 1949 and the Additional Protocol 1 of 1977, governs the use of force. According to Article 52 of the Protocol 1, military objectives are limited to objects which by their nature, location, purpose, or use at the time are making an effective contribution to military operations and whose destruction would provide a definite military advantage. It should be noted, however, that none of the nuclear sites in question were military in nature, and since they were under the direct supervision of the International Atomic Energy Agency, they were not military objectives at all, and a direct attack on them would be a clear violation of the rules of international humanitarian law. Under international law, particularly the articles on responsibility of states for wrongful acts, it may be jointly responsible if it aided and assisted Israel with knowledge of violations. This joint responsibility entails an obligation to prevent violation, an obligation to investigate and prosecute violation attributable to either party, and a duty not to support or condone violations. Let me to talk to you regarding the third state obligations in short respect. Under international humanitarian law, the international community's duty to ensure respect for IHL extends beyond direct belligerents. All states have legal obligations, including first, to refrain from aiding violations. As you know, the International Court of Justice affirmed in 2004 that states must not render aid or assistance to parties committing serious violation of humanitarian law. This includes armed transfers, military training, and financial support. Several states, including some in Europe and the Persian Gulf, continued arms sales to Israel and the U.S. during 12-day war. Such support raises complex legal and moral questions regarding complicity and enforcement. Second, to exercise influence and prevent violation. The second duty in field of issue to respect. States must actively use diplomatic means, sanctions, and multilateral forums to pressure parties to comply with IHL. And the third duty is to recognize and address violations. States must not recognize as lawful situation created by IHL violations, nor legitimize such breaches through political recognition or economic cooperation. Despite the clarity of obligation, enforcement remains problematic. The United Nations Security Council normally has authority to demand cessation of violation, establish investigate commissions, as Professor Sassoli actually referred to, impose sanctions or authorize collective enforcement. However, political vetoes, especially by the U.S., have often paralyzed meaningful responses. The post-conflict obligations also include conducting prompt, impartial investigations into allegations of war crimes, prosecuting perpetrators or extraditing them, providing reparations to victims, including compensation, restitution, and rehabilitation. It is noteworthy that failure to meet these obligations violates IHL and fuel impunity. It should be pointed out that failure to comply with this obligation is a violation of IHL and an escalation of impunity. Certainly, the continuation of such a situation could be a serious alarm. I reiterated, a serious alarm for the international community, to the extent that it can even be said that the continuation of such violations and the absence of guarantees of implementation and impunity for violation and breach of international humanitarian law in the future could pose a serious threat to international peace and security, the rule of law, and also, and the most important one, is undermine people's trust in the international legal system and its mechanisms, and could even lead to the collapse of the existing international legal order and ultimately create global chaos. As former ICRC President Jakub Kellenberger correctly and truly and precisely warned, erosion of IHL risks transferring war into under restrained violence. Now let me talk you a little bit about some, I can say, if I can name it, recommendations and the way forward. Actually, what would be the way forward and what could be the recommendation in this regard? Actually, international investigation by independent commissions should be fully supported and their recommendations acted upon. The second one could be military assistance, and arms sales must be strictly conditioned on IHL compliance. The third one could be universal jurisdiction should be prompted to enable prosecution irrespective of geography and double standards. The next one could be, which is more important, in my opinion, the multilateral diplomacy should be enhanced to depoliticize enforcement. And the last one could be civil society and media, which has the great role, must be empowered to monitor, document, and expose violations. And my final words in conclusion. The 12-day war underscores the enduring challenges and imperatives of international humanitarian law. The legal framework is clear and binding. All states must respect and ensure respect for IHL without exception. But it's quite clear that laws alone cannot prevent suffering. I remember my sentence. It is quite clear that laws alone cannot prevent suffering. They depend on political will, transparency, and accountability. So our collective responsibility is to uphold the laws of war, not only to mitigate human sufferings, but to preserve the foundations of international order and humanity. My final word is that we must believe in the power of humanity. Believing in this force will undoubtedly lead the global village to the shores of peace, tranquility, and happiness, in the hope of realizing this ancient mission of humanity. Thanks for your attention and your patience, and thank you, Dr. Makami. That is the end of my presentation.
We have a special thanks to Dr. Aslani for his meaningful speech and opinions. At this time, dear audience, you can ask your questions in English language, either typing or speaking. Before you start, I would like to ask the first question. Professor Sassoli, regards to the mentioned mechanisms, it seems that IHL is for the weak parties to the conflict. What's your comment for my students? They ask me it in the evening and in the starting educational new educational year.
Well, I think the law always protects the weaker, because without law, the more powerful have no more restraint. And we see this that now, just to take an example, the United States and President Trump doesn't care about law, while if we have law, then we have both parties are on the same level. And I wouldn't say it is always the more powerful that violate the law and the weaker that respect the law. Unfortunately, both sides violate the law. But it is also important to underline that on both sides of every armed conflict, there are also plenty of examples of respect of the law. And you know, the first armed conflict where I worked, as I already mentioned indirectly, the war between Iran and Iraq in the 1980s, there were examples of violations, but there were also plenty of examples on both sides of respect of international humanitarian law. Think about the tens of thousands of prisoners of war. Prisoners of war are evidence that people were enemies, were not killed at the front line, but were brought to safety and held in camps. There were problems, but they were not starved to death, and the ICSE was allowed to visit most of the time in both countries the prisoners. So I think we should not adopt such a pessimistic view that anyway international humanitarian law favors the powerful. I hear that often from students, especially from countries of the global south, but I ask them always, give me an example of a rule which is in the interest of the powerful and against the interest of the weak. The prohibition of torture, is this against your culture? No, it is not. The prohibition of starvation of civilians, is this against their culture? No. So I wouldn't think that international humanitarian law favors the powerful against the weak. Obviously, it is true that the more powerful a state is, the less influence can be used on that state. But I think all other states, if they work together, can even put pressure on a powerful state.
Thank you. Also, I think there are some examples that the law is in favor of the powerful party, for example, the MPT. But the question is on mechanisms. I think the mechanisms don't work for the weekends. Dear Professor Sassouli, the question is for Milad Mirna. With thanks, I had a question. Given the increasing prevalence of cyber operations in recent armed conflicts, do you believe that the existing rules of international humanitarian law are sufficient to regulate cyber warfare, or is there a need to develop a distinct legal regime, especially addressing cyber operations?
Well, thank you very much for this question, which is embarrassing for me because it's practically the only issue where I agree that the law is not adequate. Because unlike drones or even autonomous weapon systems, where I think we can work with the existing law, the problem of cyber is either it becomes, if we interpret the existing law too extensively, then even propaganda, because propaganda targets civilians. But I don't think this is a violation of IHL, becomes prohibited. And who decides what is propaganda and so on? Or if we have a too restrictive interpretation, only if there is a material damage, this is an attack. And this is too restrictive because all of us know that we consider our computer damaged even if there's no material damage, but the computer no longer works. And there are plenty of, in today's world, there are plenty of consequences, even if nothing is destroyed, but if we have no longer internet connection, then not only couldn't we have the very useful discussion today, but also ambulances could not function, power stations could not function, and so on, and the whole economic system of a country. And this must be protected, and it cannot be attacked. And the existing law is also very geographical. The danger between occupied territory and owned territory, the distinction between civilians and military objective. Well, the internet is always both, and so this. The internet clearly could be seen as a dual user object and therefore could be attacked, which is very dangerous. And therefore, ideally, we would need specific rules, and the state should take a political decision of what is tolerable and what is not tolerable in an armed conflict. While as long as we don't have this, we have nevertheless rules. So, for instance, a cyber attack against a hospital is prohibited. I wouldn't like to be defeated by saying we have no rules. No, simply the rules are not adequate for the specificities of the cyber world, because they were made for the physical world. And the cyber world has some specificities which would need not different rules, but a clarification of what the principles mean for a cyber attack.
Thank you so much. The next question is from Rasul. Mr. Aslani, Dr. Aslani, in relation to attacks on nuclear or chemical facilities, what specific limitations are imposed by international humanitarian law? And can such attacks ever be reconciled with the principle of environmental protection under IHL?
Okay, thank you for your question, Mr. Mugu, if I'm not mistaken, to pronounce the family of Mr. Rasul. A good question, actually. Under, as you know, international humanitarian law, attacks actually against nuclear installation and sites, such as nuclear power plants, nuclear reactors, etc., are subject to very strict limitations because of the grave, actually, risks to civilians and also to the environment, as you referred in your question. If I want to go through to your question analytically, actually, the principle of distinction, which has been stipulated this limitation in Articles 48 and 52, that attacks may not only be directed against military objectives, not civilian objectives, and also many nuclear sites are primarily civilian in nature, unless they are being used for direct military purposes, they are protected from attack. And the additional protocol in Article 57, nuclear electrical generating stations enjoy special protection also. Attacks on them are prohibited if such an attack may cause, for example, the release of dangerous forces and result in severe civilian losses. And also, we can refer, for example, to the principle of proportionality regarding your question, which is, even if a nuclear site is legitimate military objective, an attack is prohibited, actually, if the expected incidental civilian harm would be excessive in relation to concrete and the direct military advantage. And also, regarding the other principles, but in particular the environmental protection, IHL prohibits methods so far for expected to cause widespread, long-term, and severe damage to the natural environment, which is clearly stipulated in AP1, on additional protocol 1, if I'm not mistaken, maybe Article 35 or 55 or both of them. And attacking nuclear facilities risks massive radioactive contamination, potentially violating these rules. And also, the most important point is customary of international humanitarian law, the customary IHL, the ICRC customary IHL study rules 42 and 43 affirms protection of words containing dangerous forces. This rule is considered to reflect customary international law binding even on states not party to additional protocol 1, in the case which could Israel beat one of them in the case of all 12 they were. In summary, under IHL, I would like to tell you that attacks on nuclear sites are generally prohibited unless they are being used directly for military purposes, and attacking them would not risk catastrophic harm to civilians or the environment. As you know, the threshold is extremely high, making such attacks legally and practically very limited. I hope that I can answer the question of Mr. Ruby completely and precisely. Thank you, Mr. Ali.
Thank you, Dr. Aslani. The next question is from my colleague in my office, Ms. Bahrami. What recommendations do you have for the policy of United Nations to force members, specifically America and Israel, to obey international principles, such as the principle of distinction? Professor Sassouli, please reply here.
Well, Well, you know, don't have illusions about the United Nations. As I said, the United Nations are a club, and the club can only do what its members agree to do. And therefore, in addition, we have, as you know, the veto power in the Security Council, which is the only body which can take enforcement measures. The others, they can send a fact-finding mission and so on. But the Security Council can take enforcement measures, and sometimes in the past it has taken enforcement measures against violations of humanitarian law. But this is often selective. And if there is a permanent member or a friend of a permanent member which protects a state which violated humanitarian law, the United Nations cannot do anything. Also, I must say, I have a lot of respect, for instance, for the High Commissioner for Human Rights, who criticizes also powerful states for their violations of human rights and of international humanitarian law. Volker Türk, the High Commissioner, does not surrender before the political reality, and the United Nations is the only place we have to have to represent the common good, especially in a time like ours, where there is so much division in the world, much more than before. The United Nations are weakened, and there is a lot of bureaucracy, and I wonder whether their priorities are always the good ones, but it's the best we have, and we shouldn't expect too much from the United Nations. You know, in a lot of countries which were involved in an armed conflict, I have seen demonstrations by the population against the UN representation, and I said, no, go to demonstrate before your foreign ministry, because it's your foreign ministry who contributes to decide what the United Nations can do and what they cannot do. And if everyone was, public opinion was pressuring their own state to build more law binding, I think that would certainly help. Because, I mean, if you make, sorry to say, but if you make a demonstration against Israel in Tehran, this will not have any impact on Israel. Hmm? And even if the Iranian authorities have the best will and the best wishes to get respect of IHL in Gaza, this will not bring Israel to respect it. While if this is done in the US, in Germany, in the Netherlands, and so on. And on the other hand, you have influence, for instance, on the Houthi armed group in Yemen. So you can influence them to respect IHL and their fighting in Yemen. So I think, as Professor Aslani said, Article 1 common would be, it would be important that you exercise influence on those people on whom you have influence. And everyone has influence on some belligerents.
Thank you, Professor. The other question from my colleague in the Human Rights Research Group, Ms. Tajmiri. Professor Sassoli, based on the principle of distinction, how can belligerents and legal practitioners better navigate the notoriously difficult determination of the definite military advantage anticipated from attacking a dual-use object? I think you can read the full text of the question in the text box. Please reply, Professor
Sassoli. Well, you point to the issue I raised, that it is difficult for you, for me, for an international fact-finding commission to evaluate the proportionality because we do not know the importance of the attack on the military objective and the military advantage which will result from this attack. And often we don't even know whether it was deliberate that this was targeted or whether it was a mistake. And this changes everything for the proportionality evaluation. And this is why I think it would be important to have a transparency obligation that states must explain what they did when there are civilians who are harmed. And in case of dual use objects, yes, that would be a good idea, that as soon as you attack a dual use object, you must say how important the military use of that dual use object was. In my view, here again, the proportionality rule is the most important rule, but it is very very different. Expected civilian victims on the one hand and an abstract military advantage on the other.
I think she has a question about the burden of proof and the information required to make such a determination. Do you have any additional explanation, Professor Sassoli?
Yeah, well, I think it is important to stress that burden of proof in criminal procedure is different than in international relations. I mean, an NGO can criticize an attack even if a criminal court could never sentence an individual because there's not enough evidence. So the burden of proof is much lower in interstate relations than when it comes to the criminal responsibility of an individual. And my proposal to have a presumption could obviously not apply in criminal procedures, but could apply when determining whether a state or an armed group has violated international humanitarian law. That simply, when there is a certain kind of results, there is a presumption that the state didn't respect IHL, except if the state can explain what it did to respect IHL. And this would also increase the credibility of IHL and avoid that in public opinion there's the impression that anyway IHL doesn't work.
Thank you, Professor. My next question is about international mechanisms. Regarding mechanisms you mentioned, under Article 1 of the Geneva Conventions, all the states are obliged to ensure IHL. It means that domestic courts are authorized to prosecute and trial perpetrators of the war crimes. But whether some states, do you think that some states can establish a multilateral court to try and punish war criminals? By establishing a regional court or multilateral court.
Is this for me or for Professor Adani?
Both of you, and at first you, please, Professor Sassoli.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think the International Criminal Court as a universal court is a big progress compared with regional courts and, you know, especially if the regional courts try people who are not nationals of a country which is a party to that. So I think also in human rights law it's very important that we have regional mechanisms. In humanitarian law, I don't see how this could help, especially because the domestic courts of all states have already jurisdiction. You know that there is compulsory, at least for international armed conflict, compulsory universal jurisdiction over war crimes. So if states individually can prosecute, and if they don't do it, the International Criminal Court, which has all kinds of problems, bureaucracy, varied, complicated procedure. But I must say, since 2 years, it has made a lot of progress and credibility, because before, you remember, it was only some African rebels. Now there's Putin and Netanyahu who are under a search warrant. So they make a big effort not to be selective, and this is important for justice. But obviously, they don't have armed forces. They cannot go to arrest. But it nevertheless creates all kinds of problems for these people who can no longer travel as they traveled before, because at least in state parties to the ICC statute, they risk to be arrested.
Thank you. Yes, there is some questions as problems. How do you think, Dr. Aslani, about this idea?
Actually, thank you, Dr. Maghami, for the question. And as a very short and brief point, I would like to add to Dr. Professor Sassoli's point of view. Actually, having the universal jurisdiction of the national courts and tribunals for prosecuting the war criminals and perpetrators of international humanitarian law, I think it could be at least as an added value for confronting and combating the impunity in international humanitarian law, international criminal law, first of all. And the second point is that I think having this universal jurisdiction from the side of the national courts is not enough for actually achieving the international justice and the full combating of impunity in field of IHL and breaching and violation of international humanitarian law. I know, and all of us know, that clearly there are some barriers, obstacles, and also bureaucracy, as Professor Sassoli referred to correctly, in field of, for example, the accepting the jurisdiction of the ICC, for example, as the Universal Criminal Court at the international arena. But we have to take all the necessary actions from a national, level to international, regional and international level, but on the same rail, which is the adequacy and also the collective collaboration of the international community's opinion on combating, impunity. And also, it is, I think it could be a culture. It would be a culture of combating the international criminals, not the mechanism just for example, the structures and what should we do, what kind of secretary should we have, what kind of conference and forums. The international forums between states. Just, I think it is a culture. It is among us, first of all, as a civilian in the, for example, the territory of Islamic Republic of Iran, in the territory of Switzerland that Dr. Sassoli lives there. I think all this culture might be, or must be, it is better to say, must be collected and could be one vision and one voice that we should send and put pressure on the international community, the subjects of the international law, which are states, to do that. And we can do that. For sure, it takes time. It takes time, really, maybe a long time in the future. But anyway, to be sure that if you want, we can, because you know that the presence and the creation of the International Criminal Court is the result of the attempt of the international civil community. Now that you can see as the big structure and the great structure which has been located in Netherlands. Thank you, Mr. Malawi.
Okay, I think Rasul is writing a treatise on environmental aspects of humanitarian law. He asks Professor Sassoli, how do you assess the adequacy of Articles 35 and 55 of Additional Protocol 1 in ensuring environmental protection during armed conflict, especially considering the long-term and transboundary effects of modern warfare?
Well, I think, as many other rules, we could wish for stronger rules, and especially the long-term widespread and so on wording makes it that this article will become only rarely operational. But we must insist that the environment consists of civilian objects, because the definition of civilian object is everything which is not a military objective. And so 99% of the environment consists of civilian objects, and you may not target civilian objects. And you must take into account for the proportionality evaluation the effect on civilian objects. Now, we have also the specific rules you are referring to, but which for the time being concern only the greatest effects on the environment. And there is resistance in particular by states that have nuclear weapons, because it is clear that any use of nuclear weapons would violate specifically those rules. I mean, Hiroshima and Nagasaki was clearly, if it had already been enforced, Article 35 and 55 would have clearly been violated, because there the consequences were long-term, widespread. And I cannot imagine any use of nuclear weapon which would not violate international humanitarian law.
Okay, I think one of the audience asked to Mr. Miri, can you open the microphone? One of the audience has raised hands. I think you can open your microphone yourself. Okay, if you can't.
Dr. Magomi, she don't have a microphone.
Okay, I continue now. If you can open your microphone, please open it. I have no access to open your microphone. Continue with Dr. Aslani. Dr. Aslani, please explain us if you have any new information on the new Act of International Crimes in Majlis.
Thank you, Dr. Maghami, for your question. Actually, internally, in the Islamic Republic of Iran, in the field of the criminalization of the international crimes. Fortunately and recently, the final, act has been prepared by a team of experts from different and related authorities and organs. And fortunately, I myself and one of my colleagues, Mr. Ruzbahan, at the National Committee of IHL 6 months ago, were participated in the very high pressure and technical sessions of this committee and commission. And at the end of the day, we could be able to finalize this act. And now, if I'm not mistaken, it is in the corridors of the national parliament and in the specialized committees of the Islamic parliament. And I hope that it will be actually ratified by the national parliament and we can accept the universal jurisdiction according to this code. And regarding the technicalities and the substance of this act, I would like to inform you, Professor Sassoli, and all the audiences that all the international standards, all the articles of the Constitution of ICC has been stipulated and prepared and localized also in this act. Unfortunately, I can say that it could be and it would be a complete version of the national act, which is actually, we can compare it uniquely with the International Criminal Court Constitution.
Well, this is very good news. Thank you.
And you're welcome, Dr. Sassoli.
Professor Sassoli, do you have any recommendation for lawmakers in this regard?
Well, I think the approach to be as close as possible to the ICC statute is a good idea. Obviously, one can always go a little further. Like for non-international armed conflict, the ICC statute does not criminalize violation of the proportionality rule. Well, I think it would be important to include that. But to have the IAC, the same incriminations than the ICC statute is already a very important step. And then the greatest difficulty is to organize this. You know, the Swiss law is very good, but the public prosecutor has only two people who look into this. And in Geneva, there are plenty of people who could have committed war crimes who are around it. And therefore, two people are not sufficient. So often it is also a question of having the necessary resources to apply the law. But to have the law is already an important first step.
Thank you. Is there any new question? Other question? Okay. Today's international session named IHL Accountability for Civilian and Dual Use Structures Attacks. Okay. Maybe was finished. Do you have a microphone? If you have a microphone, you can ask your question. I think it is finished now. I and the Human Rights Research Group of the University of Isfahan have respectfully special thanks to our dear colleagues. Okay. I think you can now speak.
Hello, respect. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay. Hello, respect, especially Professor Sassoli and Dr. Amir Maghami and his colleague. And thank you for your meaningful speeches. I honorably ask a question, Professor Sassoli. And thank you in advance. Especially the recent events for Iran and Israel. Given Americans' involvement in Israel's aggressions, what measures the UN organization should take against Israel and America aggressions towards Palestine and Iran and humanitarian law? Thank you.
Well,
thank you. Please ask.
Thank you. Well, this is what I said before. The UN cannot take enforcement measures without the Security Council resolution, and the United States would veto it, just as Russia vetoes any resolution for enforcing humanitarian law in Ukraine. Obviously, the Human Rights Council could establish an inquiry mission, and Iran could suggest that. I don't know whether there would be a majority. Perhaps there would be a majority. On Gaza, there are plenty of international fact-finding mechanisms, and I think this contributes to the pressure on Israel to respect international humanitarian law. And there are also domestic procedures, both by courts. You have perhaps heard that in the Netherlands, the courts have prohibited to the government to continue to deliver weapons to Israel, but also government, even Germany, which has a special relationship with Israel, has recently decided no longer to supply weapons which could be used in Gaza. And this is certainly also the result of pressure by civil society, and is an application of Article 1 Common. And the United Kingdom has now also considered that it must take sanctions against Israel, and at least in the European Union, where there are still quite divergences, they consider whether they suspend certain parts of the free trade agreement with Israel. And similar things, and here there is a certain double standard, I must admit, a lot of measures have been taken against Russia and its conduct in Ukraine. While, for instance, no one speaks about Eastern Congo. You know that in Eastern Congo in the last 30 years, 5 million people have been killed by the armed conflict, which is fueled by Rwanda and those who want to profit from the natural resources in the Congo. So here too, there is no enforcement measure by the UN, but for instance, there are regular reports by a UN body which was established by the Human Rights Council and another one by the Security Council to determine who contributes to those violations by trafficking natural resources from the Eastern Congo.
Thank you, Professor. Dr. Aslani, there is another question from Ms. Tajmiri. How has Iran, through the Red Crescent Society, adopted strategies to promote international humanitarian law in modern conflicts, especially involving non-state actors, and ensure these strategies reach both the public and military personnel?
Thank you for your question, Ms. Tajmiri. Actually, the Iranian Red Crescent Society, and particularly the National Committee for IHL, is one of the old national committees throughout more than 113 national committees throughout the world. Unfortunately, during the last 20 years, more than two decades of our activities in field of training and dissemination of IHL, we have done several various and different programs, seminars, forums, workshops, proposals, projects, and etc. But the main issue here is the main audience of the international humanitarian law rules and principles, and especially the dissemination and training of Geneva Conventions, provisions, and additional protocols and other related documents is the military forces. Fortunately, if I'm not mistaken, last 5 years ago till now, we had started a very good and close communication and cooperation with the military forces, especially the military forces, I think the naval forces, and etc. And we had different workshops, and also we have some, for example, maneuvers, I mean the legal maneuvers on the paper for them, and it was very fruitful. But regarding the strategies, I mean what kind of strategies actually adapted to promote IHL in modern conflicts. Fortunately, we have a section in the military forces of Islamic Republic of Iran, the command of cyber, I mean command, cyber command section inside the military forces, that we have a very good connection. We have also several and regular meetings with them regarding the cyber attacks, the attributability of the cyber attacks, and etc., and the other technical and legal ramifications of the cyberspace with the military forces. And we came to this conclusion that we can have, first of all, to have the the scientific and technical workshops in field of scholars and experts in field of cyberspace, and we want to engage also the ICRC committee, the ICRC, sorry, delegation in Iran, in Tehran, especially to work with them and involve them in our, discussions. And also we have to have several, discussions and roundtables. In the past, of course, we had, and in the future that we want to go to have, codify a new strategy in field of new technologies and warfare with the military forces. That it is the beginning. We are at the very beginning of the process, and hopefully, according to the opinions and point of view of our military forces, the high-ranked ones, we hope that in the future we can, have the good results in this field.
Thank you again. I think the questions is finished. I and the Human Rights Research Group of the University of Isfahan have respectfully special thanks to our dear guests and dear audience, especially Professor Sassouli from the University of Geneva, and Dr. Aslani. And finally, I would like to have a special thanks to my dear colleagues in the Human Rights Group and other people helping us to hold today's meeting, including Mr. Sagafian and Mr. Miri. I should repeat Professor Sassouli's opinion that I read in one of his work. There is no peace without justice. Thank you all, and thank you, Professor. Thank you, Dr. Aslani.
Thank you.
Right. Have a good night.
Goodbye.
Good night.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thank you all.
Thank you. Thank you.